Our passage this evening comes from Genesis chapter 24. You may have suffered a little shock when you saw that there are 67 verses in it, wondering if we're going to read them all. I just have this to say about that. There have been worse things done in church than reading Scripture. We look at Genesis 24 tonight, and we won't read quite all the chapter, but it's a longer narrative, but it all hangs together. We will summarize part of it, but we're going to read a good chunk of it to get it before us. Genesis chapter 1 will begin at beginning at verse 1. Now Abraham was old, up in years, and Yahweh had blessed Abraham in every way. Then Abraham said to his servant, the oldest in his household, who had oversight over all that belonged to him, "Please place your hand under my thigh. And I want you to swear by Yahweh, God of heaven and God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but that you will go to my land and to my relatives and take a wife for my son for Isaac." And the servant said to him, "Perhaps the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Am I to take your son back to the land from which you came out?" And Abraham said to him, "Watch out that you do not take my son back there. Yahweh, God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my relatives, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, 'To your seed I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. And if the woman's not willing to follow you, then you shall be clear of this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there." So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of his master Abraham and went on oath to him about this matter. And the servant took 10 camels from his master's camels and went off, along with all sorts of his master's goods with him. So he rose and went to Aram Naharaim, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city at the well of water at evening time, at the time the women are coming out to draw water. And he said, "O Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, grant me success today and act with steadfast love toward my master Abraham. Look, I'm standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. And it shall be that the girl to whom I say, 'Please drop down your jug that I can have a drink,' and she shall say, 'Drink, and what's more, I will water your camels,' let her be the one you have appointed for your servant Isaac to have. And by this I will know that you have acted with steadfast love toward my master." Now it happened that before he had finished speaking, why, Rebekah was coming out. She had been born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, wife of Nahor, the brother of Abraham. She had her jug on her shoulder. And the girl was very good looking, a young woman. No man had had intimate relations with her. And she went down to the spring, filled her jug, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please give me a bit of water to drink from your jug." And she said, "Drink, my lord." And she hurriedly let down her jug upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw water for your camels as well until they have finished drinking." So she hurried and poured her jug into the trough, then ran again to the well to draw water. So she watered all his camels. And the man kept watching her in silence to know whether Yahweh had granted success to his journey or not. Now when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half a shekel and 2 bracelets for her hands weighing 10 gold shekels. And he said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge?" And she said to him, "I'm the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Then she said to him, "We have plenty of straw and feed and room for you to lodge." Then the man bowed down and worshipped Yahweh, and he said, "How blessed is Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and faithfulness with my master. As for me, Yahweh led me on the road to the house of my master's brothers." Now the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things, and Rebekah had a brother, and his name was Laban, and Laban ran to the man who was outside the spring. When he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's hands, and when he heard Rebekah, his sister's words, saying, "Here's what the man spoke to me," he came to the man, and there he was, standing by the camels by the spring. And he said, "Come in, O blessed one by Yahweh. Why do you stand outside? And I have prepared the house and room for the camels." So the man came to the house and unloaded the camels, and straw and feed was given to the camels, and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. And there was set before him something to eat. Then he said, "I will not eat until I have spoken my business." And he said, "Speak." Now in verses 34 to 49, you have about 15 verses, which is a speech by Abraham's servant, in which he relates that Abraham is very rich. He has given everything he has to his son Isaac, and that he's seeking a wife in regard to Abraham's instructions to come back, to take back with him. And he tells the whole story of his prayer at the well, of the exact fulfillment of that prayer in Rebekah's actions, and then he puts it up to Laban and her father. So what do I do now? So we pick up the reading at verse 50. Verse 50. "Then Laban answered along with Bethuel, and they said, 'The matter has come out from Yahweh. We're not able to speak to you bad or good. See, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her become the wife of your master's son, as Yahweh has spoken.' When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed to the ground before Yahweh. Then the servant brought out items of silver and items of gold and clothes and gave them to Rebekah. And he gave fine gifts to her brother and her mother. So they ate and drank, he and the men who were with him, and stayed the night. Then they rose in the morning, and he said, 'Send me back to my master.' And her brother and her mother said, 'Let the girl stay with us some days, say 10. After that she can go.' Then he said to them, 'Do not delay me. It is Yahweh who has made my journey successful. Send me off and let me go to my master.' And they said, 'We will call the girl and ask what she wants.' So they called Rebekah and said, 'Will you go with this man?' And she said, 'I will go.' So then they sent Rebekah, their sister, off along with her nurse and Abraham's servant and his men. And they uttered a blessing on Rebekah and said to her, 'Our sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s, and may your seed possess the gates of those who hate you.' Then Rebekah rose up along with her servant girls and rode on the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and went off. Now Isaac had come from visiting Beer Lahai-Roi. He was dwelling in the south country. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening. And he lifted up his eyes and looked. Why, camels were coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes and saw Isaac. And so she got down from the camel. And she said to the servant, 'Who is this man walking in the field to meet us?' And the servant said, 'He is my master.' So she took her veil and covered herself. Then the servant related to Isaac all the things that he had done. And Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. And he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death." Here ends the reading of God's sacred word. Now let's say, what if you wanted to lead a Bible study for your youth group on finding a life's mate, and you use Genesis 24 and you call it guidance and girls. And you tell them, make certain points. First, put yourself in a place where you'll meet fellas or gals, verse 11. You may have to do a little jumbling there as to why a bar is not a good cultural equivalent for a well outside the village, but you get the point. Number two, commit the matter to prayer, verses 12 and 13. Number three, make your prayer specific, verse 14. Too many prayers are too general. Number four, don't forget to give thanks, verses 26 and 27. Number five, you need to meet the family, verses 28 to 51. You don't marry them, but it'll help explain a few weird things, perhaps, that you need to know about. Now, Now that we know how not to interpret Genesis 24, we can proceed ahead. What is the chapter about? It's about God's promise program for the nations meeting another glitch. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, stands behind practically every story of Abraham, and it does so here again. Yahweh intends to bring his kingdom into this world through Abraham's seed. And finally, Abraham has that seed, Isaac. But the problem is that the seed needs seed, that is, descendants. And the seed won't get seed if he doesn't get married. At least that's the way it was back then. Yahweh's promise plan seems to lurch along, doesn't it? You've seen it again and again. Yahweh's promise plan seems to lurch along by stutters and stops, a hindrance here, a roadblock there, and now here's another one. That's the story then of a covenant romance. So what does this account of the covenant romance teach us? I think we can sum it up in several propositions, if you want to put it that way. First of all, God's promises require faithful activity. Verses 1 to 9. God's promises require faithful activity. Abraham has God's promises. He wants to see them continue in effect with his son Isaac and so on. But there's a certain amount of activity that he is responsible to care for this, what you might call covenant continuity down to the next generation. There are two non-negotiable requirements that Abraham lays on his servant in verses 1 to 9. One is Isaac must not marry one of the Canaanite girls in the land, verse 3. And the other is in verse 6, you must not take Isaac, my son, back to my original homeland. Those are two non-negotiables. And the servant says, well, what if the girl won't come, etc.? And Abraham in verse 7 expresses his faith. Yahweh will send his angel before you. It's about his same way of saying in chapter 22, verse 8, God will see to it. He'll take care of this. But those are two non-negotiable matters. Isaac can't be taken back to his original homeland because Yahweh called Abraham out of that homeland to the land of Canaan and said, to your seed I will give this land. So Isaac must stay here. He can't be taken back there. That would be contrary to God's promise and plan. And he must not take a wife for Isaac from the daughters of the Canaanites. Verse 3. Abraham seemed to sense, didn't he, that a marriage could wreck a covenant relationship. And he didn't want to have Isaac to have anything to do with a Canaanite girl. Now, why would that be the case? Well, he knew, for one thing, whether Abraham knew the tradition in chapter 9, verses 25 to 27 or not, nevertheless, the Lord had told him in chapter 15, verse 16, that the Amorites and the Canaanites and so on, the people in the land, were going to come under God's judgment for their iniquity when it reached full term. So he knew that they were a people under judgment eventually. And he lived among the Canaanites. And if their lifestyle was anything like it was in the following years, then it was a corrupt and polluted lifestyle. The Canaanites were a sex-centered, sex-perverted culture. And Abram didn't want Isaac to have a wife from the Canaanites. Now, that was a costly thing for Abraham, because one of the coolest moves he could have made would have been to have a marriage alliance with one of the local Canaanite chieftains. Think what that would do. You'd have all the clout of Abraham's clan with the clout of a major Canaanite chieftain, and combined together in a marriage alliance, that would be militarily and economically sharp, but Abraham won't do it. Now, he has a sense, doesn't he, that their wrong move in terms of a marriage could destroy and cause the covenant to go down the drain. Now, he didn't have much choice. when he sends his servant back to his homeland, it's not like those girls were all ARP church members who held to the Westminster Confession of Faith. They were pagans too! But the paganism in Aram Naharaim apparently wasn't as debased and intense as it was in Canaan. And so you take your choice and you go back to your homeland to get a wife. Now, this impulse, though, that Abraham shows, that there can be a peril to the covenant in the area of marriage. When he realizes how crucial holy marriages are among the covenant people in order to maintain faithfulness to God's, to God of the covenant, how critical that is. And the Apostle Paul takes that up, doesn't he, in the New Testament? Almost by the way, in a way, in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39, he's talking about a Christian widow. Her husband dies and she's a widow, and she's free to marry whoever she wants, only in the Lord. That is, she must marry someone who is united to Christ by faith. She must marry another believer. That's the principle. Well, that tells us, doesn't it, that it's crucial then, this whole area of marriage in our families. Holy marriage is crucial if God's people are going to go on living in covenant faithfulness to him. Abraham seemed to know, for example, that if Isaac married a Canaanite girl, you could kiss the covenant goodbye sooner or later. Of course, we know this. And of course, the problem for some of us, isn't it, when we seek to apply this, because this is one instance, isn't it? When you seek to apply this across the board and so on, you have to say, what if there's not a Rebecca? Because that can sometimes be the case, or an Isaac, as the case may be. You've probably heard of J. Gresham Machen, the New Testament scholar, who was at Princeton Seminary for a while and then at Westminster Seminary, and who was very instrumental in forming what was later the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And Machen, about 1920, 1921, had an incipient kind of friendship, a relationship with a young lady in Boston. Their families had vacationed in the same place in New England, and they had met. He'd taken her to a football game, and they had written a few letters and were apparently pretty well devoted to one another for some time. And Machen's brother described this young lady as intelligent, beautiful, exquisite. Now, it doesn't get much better than that. But she was a Unitarian. And so Machen, as time went along, sought to explain and lead her and speak with her and persuade her to faith in the gospel and to embrace the Christian faith. For I don't know how long that went on, but eventually it became clear that she couldn't bring herself to do that. Well, Machen could not join himself and his life to someone who couldn't share in his same faith, and so the relationship was terminated, and he remained single. Sometimes God can do that too. It's not always that there's a kind of a marvelous story. You might say sometimes God may call one of his covenant people to singleness and call him or her to make, as it were, a statement that his or her relation to Jesus matters more than anything else. But covenant promises require faithful activity. Now then, secondly, God's providence maintains God's promises. God's providence maintains God's promises. Now, this is in verses 10 to 61, so this swallows most of the narrative. But you see, the promises here are at stake. They're on the table. They're functioning, you might say. There's going to be the land that is given to Isaac and a people that is supposed to come from Isaac. But those are the promises. But how are those promises going to be maintained? Because there's a certain biological fact. If Isaac doesn't get married and have kids, the people of God that are to inherit this land just aren't going to be. So how will the promises be maintained? The answer is by God's providence, by his marvelous, secret, interesting, fascinating way of weaving events and circumstances, etc., to support his promises. So we need to look here at God's providence, and I can only highlight a couple of matters. The one thing, notice here the minor characters in God's providence. You notice this servant of Abraham. You notice how he dominates the whole narrative. In fact, as I said in the scripture reading, there's one section, verses 34 to 49, which is all his speech. That's pretty predominant. You don't usually have long speeches like that in narratives. That's a very long speech recorded. He really dominates the narrative. And how good God was to give a servant like this to Abraham, a godly and faithful servant. You notice what a model servant he is in verses 12 to 14, the way he prays at the well, the way he seeks to promote Abraham's interests, the way he worships immediately in verses 26 and 27, and then again in verse 52 after he gets the okay from Rebekah's relatives. This, what a godly, gracious man he seems to be. And yet, everything, in a way, seems to lean on him. That's often the case in God's dramas. There was that time when General Lee was out. This was after the war between the states. He was out riding with a friend, and Shelby Foote says this was a time when he wasn't speaking on the record, and he let himself drift into personalities one time at least. He was riding with his friend, and apparently as they were looking out over the field, Lee began to muse, and he said, "If I had had Stonewall Jackson, then as far as man can see, I should have won the Battle of Gettysburg." Now, if I'd had that one, that's the way it is here. There's this servant on which everything depends. And yet, he's no Stonewall because we don't know his name. You say, well, he must be the same as a servant in chapter 15, Eliezer. You don't know that. Eliezer could have died and be buried by now. We don't know. It just doesn't specify what his name is. He is nameless. Minor characters in God's providence. How often God uses ordinary, no-name type of people to bring good to you in working for your benefit and in your circumstances. Haven't you seen that? The God of the Bible is not dependent on all-stars. Now, not only minor characters, but notice here the interesting development of God's providence. You notice how you mix circumstances, verse 11, where he's at the well and the women of the town are coming out to draw water. You mix circumstances, verse 11, with prayer, verses 12 and 13, and you see what happens. And there are fascinating matters here. In this whole episode. For one thing, do you notice that Yahweh never speaks? Now, Yahweh is referred to a number of times, either by the servant or eventually by Laban, etc. But Yahweh himself never speaks. It's as if he's in the background, as it were. And then you notice the test proposed by the servant in verse 14. That, if I ask, please drop your jug down so I can have a drink, and she'll say, drink, and what's more, I will water your camels. Let her be the one you've appointed. And then you notice in verses 18 to 20, Rebekah fulfills that scheme. That would be not just a sign for him, but it was also a revelation of character that Rebekah would show, that she was not only courteous, but that she was kind and industrious as well. You can imagine it almost leads you at this point to think of a what-if situation, doesn't it? You know, what if you see beautiful Rebekah coming to the well, chomping on a wad of bubble gum? And after she gives the servant his drink, she says, yeah, okay, like you asked for a drink, and that's like cool, but don't expect any more. Like those camels drink liters and liters, and if I like messed with them, I'd like be here all evening. Besides, just while I've been getting water, I've had like two texts on my iPhone, and I want to like answer them. Can you imagine something like that? Well, yeah, I suppose you can, but that's not the way it happened. Here is Rebekah, and the servant had a reason for stating the sign in his prayer that way. She had a water jug. That was probably something like 3 gallons. You do the math. The servant had 10 camels. Camels lose about 25 gallons of water, roughly, apparently, on their journeys. And so 10 camels, each needing 25 gallons of water, and she has a jug of maybe 3 gallons. And if she says, I'll water your camels, she's going down 80 to 85 times to that well and filling her jug and slopping it into the trough. There is a woman who can work. There is a woman who's kind to the second power. That's a revelation of character on her part as well. A fascinating sort of thing, isn't it? And then he asks her who she is and so on. The writer tells you that she was Rebekah and tells you how she was related to Abraham's family in verse 15. But the servant didn't know that in verse 15. He didn't find that out until verse 24. Not only is this, doesn't how she fulfill the signs that he asked for, but this woman, is also exactly from Abraham's family and relatives. How God's providence works. Now, what's that meant to show us? I think it's meant to show us the twists and turns and surprises of God's providence never cease, and they were certainly operating here. But isn't that meant to come off the page and grab you by your lapels and say, I've seen that before as well? Isn't God fascinating? Now, you all have stories. I think there are probably 3 to 5 stories that most believers could have and conjure up of the interesting, fascinating ways of God's providences in their own experience. I just think of one that I came upon again recently. And there was in about 1841 a young lad by the name of Adolf Safer. He was 11 years old at the time, and he came to faith in the gospel and faith in Jesus. He was a Jewish lad. Now, if you had asked him to give his testimony at some point, it would have gotten a little bit involved. How so? Well, you see, back in 1838, the church in Scotland thought that they needed to send some men to check out how to do evangelism among Jews in the Middle East and in Europe. So they sent 4 men, Robert Murray McShane, Andrew Bonar, a Dr. Keith, and a Dr. Black, to the Middle East, and they were checking things out in their survey. They were down in Egypt. They were traveling up to what is now Israel, and they were on camels, and they were coming through the Sinai Desert. And the heat of the day got to Dr. Keith. He started to doze and so on, and lo and behold, he slid off that camel and boom, right into the sand. Well, I didn't think too much of it, but it apparently was a harder and more serious fall than they thought, and it became apparent that Dr. Keith and Dr. Black were going to need to return to Scotland. Well, contrary to their original plans, Keith and Black decided to return by way of the Danube and so on, and to go through what was then called Pest, now Budapest, in Hungary, and spend a few days in Pest. But they were detained longer than that because while they were there, they got the Danube fever. Dr. Keith collapsed in the street, had to be carried to his hotel room, and he was in a coma for 6 weeks. His friend Dr. Black was in the adjacent room but couldn't do anything to help him because he had Danube fever. So there they were. Well, the Archduchess, who had marvelously been worked upon by the Spirit of God and brought to faith in the gospel and in the Lord Jesus, heard about their situation, and she aided them in their illness and then asked them to return and work among the people. Well, they went back to Scotland, and in 1841, after they had stirred up some interest, the church decided to send, among others, Dr. John Duncan, an Old Testament professor, to go and work there among the Jews in Budapest or in Pest. Well, Dr. Duncan went, but it was difficult. It was a Roman Catholic country, a staunch Roman Catholic country, so you just couldn't do things blatantly. But there were English workmen in the city, and so they could hold services for the English workmen. But lo and behold, some of the Jews in the community began to attend these services. One of them was Israel Safer. Israel Safer was a merchant, an educator. He was a scholar. He was the most revered Jew in Hungary. He was a friend of the chief rabbi. He was Mr. Judaism. And he came to these services to improve his English. But he got to talking with Dr. Duncan, and they started talking about messianic prophecies in the Old Testament and how they were fulfilled in Jesus and so on. And gradually, the light began to dawn, and Israel Safer never came to these meetings without this frail, thin-looking little 11-year-old boy who stood between his knees when he sat down, and his name was Adolf. And he, too, came to faith. But now what if Adolf Safer was asked to give his testimony? What would he do? Well, he would have to say it all began when a Scotsman fell off his camel in the Sinai Desert. Isn't God fascinating? Isn't he interesting in the ins and outs of his providence? And the thing is that we don't just observe that, whether in Genesis 24 or in his own working in our lives, but the text tells us that there's a proper response to God's providence, doesn't it? Worship. You notice how the servant in verses 26 and 27 immediately went to worship and praise and blessing Yahweh for how he had brought about this good favor to his master Abraham. You don't just there look at the providence and say, isn't that interesting? No, you engage in praise and you fall in your face and you give adoration to the interesting God for what he has done. God's providence maintains God's promises. Now, third, notice that God's provision satisfies his servants. God's provision satisfies his servants. Verses 62 to 67, and especially want to draw your attention to verse 67 there. This is the end of the narrative. Rebekah comes back. Isaac is in the field. He looks up. There are camels coming. Rebecca looks up and she sees a man coming. She finds out that that's the servant's master, in this case Isaac. We would expect him to report to Abraham, but instead, verse 66, he reports to Isaac. And then you have the climax of the episode in verse 67, and Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and he took Rebecca, and she became his wife. And he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Isn't that interesting? Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Now, what's at stake here? Well, what's at stake is the whole promise and kingdom plan of God. Why, there'll be no people of God in this world if Isaac doesn't get his wife and start having kids. It's sort of a biological necessity. But what do you have in the last of verse 67? You find out in the last of verse 67 that the story isn't only about Yahweh's plan, but it's about human need. You see, Isaac isn't just a cog in God's plan for the world, but he's a hurting person for whom God cares. And why does he hurt? Because he misses his mother. Sigmund Freud, call your office. Nothing unusual about that or sick about that. According to the chronology and so on of Genesis, Sarah was 90 years old when she had Isaac. She died at 127, so Isaac was 37 when his mother died. They apparently had quite a bond between them. We have to assume that. That's what the text seems to allege and suggests, a closeness and so on. And there was a huge hole in Isaac's life because of this. And what's interesting here is what God does about it. He gave Isaac someone to love, a wife, Rebekah. Interesting, isn't it, when it mentions her as his wife, it says, and he loved her. What else are you supposed to do for a wife? That's it. He loved her. And then he was comforted after his mother's death. God stooped down and began to fill the hole in Isaac's life. See, what's so interesting here is not just the meeting of Isaac's need. It's what this text says about God. It's always about God, you know. What's it say? It says, Yahweh is the God of the big plan. That's what most of Genesis 24 is about. He's the God of the big plan, and he's the God of the individual need. He cared about this huge hole in Isaac's life. You know, when you're among the covenant people and you have Yahweh as your God, you're not lost in a massive crowd. God sees his individual servants. It's like Paul Gerhardt wrote in hymn number 669 in a Trinity hymnal. Give to the wind your fears, hope, and be undismayed. God hears your sighs and counts your tears. God shall lift up your head. That's the kind of God you have. Now, there's the story then of a covenant romance. It's a beautiful story, but that's just reflection, isn't it, of the beauty of the Lord our God. Now, our God, once again, our hearts are filled with thankfulness. For who is a God like you, so ingenious in his ways, so satisfying to his people? And so once more in Jesus' name, we gather in gratitude at your feet and give our thanks to you. Amen.